some program. Power to people.
I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brent Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
And coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregonians call for Governor Ted Kulongowski to keep the National Guard home. Leftist presidential candidate wins El Salvadorian election. And we'll hear from the mother of peace activist Rachel Corey on the 6th anniversary of her death.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 16, 2009. I'm Eddie Greenlee.
And I'm Ani. Around 500 Oregonians gathered in Salem yesterday for a march and rally to keep Oregon's National Guard home. Today, activists held a legislative day of action on the issue. They visited the offices of Oregon state legislators to ask for support for HB 2556, which authorizes Governor Ted Kulongowski to keep the men and women in the Oregon National Guard from deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan. Veteran Leah Bolger with Veterans for Peace helped organize the action and talked to KBOO at yesterday's march.
I went out here today to show our state legislature that we're not going to stand for this. You know, we're speaking out. We're saying we want the Guard to stay here. You know, there is something we do to fight back against this immoral, illegal war. I spent 20 years in the Navy on active duty. I'm currently the National Vice President of Veterans for Peace. Well, I am opposed to the war in general, but the thing that, about this campaign is that, you know, even if you think that the occupation or the invasion was justified in the beginning, it's certainly not the job of the Oregon National Guard to be fighting on the front lines. That's not their intended to do. That's not what they're trained to do. And so even if you support in the beginning, you don't think it's the job for the Guard to do. We need the Guard to stay here, and Governor Kulongowski needs to make the decision in the best interest of this state and its people.
That was veteran Leah Bolger at yesterday's Peace March in Salem.
A bicyclist named Freedom Child appeared in federal court today to begin a civil lawsuit against the police department and the city of Portland. Ms. Child was assaulted by plainclothes Portland police officers in August of 2003. The officers threw her down on the ground and dragged her by her hair for not using a bike light. After filing a lawsuit with the Independent Police Review, the panel dismissed her case using its new power to treat lawsuits as complaints. For years, Ms. Child appeared regularly at the police department's Citizen Review Committee to argue her side. But the IPR's earlier dismissal has effectively denied her the right to an appeal. Ms. Child's federal complaint apparently addressed the officers who assaulted her, as well as the Portland Police Department's mishandling of her case.
New employment numbers show that Oregon's unemployment rate shot up by a full percentage point to 10.8% last month. This is the highest rate since July 1983 and is much higher than the national rate of 8.1%. The February numbers for Oregon showed the state lost 21,700 jobs as Oregon's economy continued to struggle more than most others in the nation. In its news report, the Oregon Employment Department said all seven of Oregon's largest private sector industry sectors shed jobs, led by a loss of 4,900 manufacturing jobs. Overall, Oregon's unemployment rate translated to 236,286 Oregonians on the jobless rolls last month. The employment agency said Oregon's unemployment rate has risen rapidly over the past 8 months, from a rate of 5.9% last June to double digits in the latest estimate. Meanwhile, the national jobless rate rose from 7.6% in January to last month's 8.1% mark.
A bill has been introduced into the Oregon State Legislature that would direct the Department of Human Services to create and operate a marijuana production facility. House Bill 3274 would impose a $98 per ounce tax to cover the state's cost of operating and securing the production center. State-produced marijuana would be distributed to pharmacies for dispensing to medical marijuana cardholders and designated primary caregivers. Oregon's current medical marijuana law authorizes registered patients with a debilitating illness to possess 6 mature cannabis plants that were grown or obtained by a registered private grower. Supporters say the bill reduces complications in current state law that bans the purchase of marijuana, which results in a lack of oversight on private growers. The bill calls for the closing of private marijuana grow sites and gives pharmacies the option of opting out of the program, which currently violates federal law. Critics of the bill charge that most pharmacies will not risk losing their business license, which will create a de facto prohibition with no alternative of procuring medical marijuana. The bill is expected to be heard in committee due to its bipartisan support, but House Speaker Dave Hunt believes the bill has a slim chance of passage.
The National Association of Broadcasters has filed a lawsuit against the Federal Communications Commission in an attempt to put low-power FM stations out of business. Sakura Saunders is with the Prometheus Radio Project, a group promoting low-power FM radio.
The National Association of Broadcasters is suing the FCC because the FCC actually did something good for low-power radio stations. Low-power radio currently is kind of like a second-class citizen on the FM dial. So if a full-power station wants to move where their transmitter is located, they can do so even if they're going to knock off a low-power radio station in the process. They basically can move around and change location and basically act as if the low-power radio station didn't even exist. What happened recently is that the FCC changed some policies so that it made it easier for full-power stations to move. And what happened as a result is all of a sudden there was hundreds of stations that faced a small degree of encroachment, meaning that their signal strength was compromised, the coverage area was going to be compromised, but 40 stations were being faced with being thrown off the air entirely. And this happened locally with KPCN, the farm workers radio station in Woodburn, Oregon, run by Pacoon. This also happened with a radio station that I helped build in my old college town, KDRT. So 40 of these stations were going to get kicked off the air entirely, and the FCC decided to intervene. And so what the FCC did was they, you know, negotiated with other radio stations in the area and tried to find a spot that these stations could move to. In doing so, they allowed these radio stations to exist 2 adjacent channels next to another full-power radio station. You know, basically what happened was if there was a low-power radio station nearby that was facing getting kicked off the air nearby Portland, Oregon, then they might ask you if they could be at 90.5. And they would do these engineering studies to show that there was going to be no major interference based on this move. And then they would get you, KBOO, to agree to do that. And these were all brokered agreements. And as far as we know, there was no actual broadcaster that complained about this process. But the NAB has decided to sue the FCC anyways about it, which we just think is kind of spiteful. Another interesting fact about this lawsuit is that the NAB's entire argument is based on the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act. This is an awful piece of legislation that we've been working to repeal in Congress. And it actually looks like we're going to be successful in repealing this bad piece of legislation, because right now we have the Local Community Radio Act, and it's with bipartisan leadership. We have the bill in both the House and the Senate. And once this piece of legislation passes, the NAB's entire argument is moot. So the only thing that the NAB will gain from having this lawsuit is having those 40 radio stations being kicked off the air. And these radio stations, many of them are stations that are very near and dear to all of us at Prometheus.
That was Sakura Saunders of the Prometheus Radio Project.
President Obama now will have the opportunity to stand up for the rights of gay couples, as he promised during his presidential campaign. Two judges of the Federal Appeals Court in California have ruled that same-sex partners of federal employees were entitled to health benefits. However, the Federal Office of Personnel Management has instructed insurers not to provide the benefits ordered by the judges, citing the Defense of Marriage Act, which prohibits federal recognition of state-sanctioned gay relationships. The assistant director of the personnel office told the federal judiciary that the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program may not provide coverage for domestic partners or legally married partners of the same sex, even though recognized by state law. President Obama and his choice for director of the personnel office, M. John Berry, have endorsed the idea of providing health benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees. Some legal experts believe Obama has discretionary authority to give benefits to gay couples. Groups on both sides of the issue are mobilizing lobbying efforts.
12 separate briefs have been filed requesting that the U.S. Supreme Court review the criminal convictions of five political prisoners known as the Cuban Five. The men were indicted on various charges, including conspiracy in 1998, after being arrested while monitoring anti-Cuban mercenary groups operating in South Florida. International support for the Cuban Five has increased amidst concerns that the trial was conducted in an atmosphere of anti-Cuba sentiment and fear of retaliation. The United Nations Human Rights Commission condemned the Miami trial, saying the proceedings did not conform to the standards of a fair trial. The briefs were filed by a number of high-profile figures, including 10 Nobel Prize winners, a former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and members of the European Parliament.
The U.S. military says a 12-year-old girl was killed in Iraq today when American soldiers fired at a vehicle near the northern city of Mosul. Also in Mosul, an Iraqi soldier was killed last night in a gun battle with resistance fighters, and a civilian was injured in a car bomb in the city. On Sunday, four Iraqi soldiers were killed in an armed attack on a checkpoint near Samarra, north of Baghdad. And in the city of Baghdad, a grenade exploded prematurely, killing a gunman and wounding three civilians in the Mansour district on Sunday evening. On Saturday, in the Mansour district of Baghdad, two Iraqi soldiers were wounded when a roadside bomb exploded near an Iraqi army patrol. Three people were wounded by a roadside bomb on Saturday in the Dawoudi district of western Baghdad. A total of 19 Iraqis were killed over the weekend, and four Kurdish rebels were also killed in a number of different attacks.
The human cost of the occupation in Iraq. Multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. Over the weekend, four U.S. soldiers were killed in a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. A total of 666 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan since the U.S. invasion in 2001. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, hosted by your friendly neighborhood letter carrier, Kevin Card, at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, followed by Hard Knock Radio, news from a hip-hop perspective, at 7. Tomorrow's weather is wet, with showers mainly before 11 a.m., high near 50. Chance of rain, just about 80%.
Current time is about 5:16. Now, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The rich truly are different from you and me, for they are treated differently. I'm not talking about the merely affluent, but about the ultra-rich, those Wall Street elites who annually pocket tens of millions of dollars each through such financial entities as hedge funds and private equity firms. While you and I earn the bulk of our money from wages or ordinary income, as economists so snobbishly call it, the richy rich don't receive anything as pedestrian as income. No, no, they have gains. Aside from the snoop factor, what's the difference? The tax code. Our ordinary income is taxed by the feds at a rate of up to 35%. The very rich, however, who haul in most of their money from capital gains and stock gains, pay only 15% on this income. What's at work here is another big difference between us and them. They have lobbyists and are able to make impressive levels of campaign contributions to key politicians. So, the tax code has been deliberately perverted to benefit them. Oh, tut tut, sniffed these swell ones. We take big investment risks with our money, and we fuel America's entrepreneurial spirit. So we are, in fact, special and deserve preferential tax treatment. Good grief, Daddy Warbucks. Spare us your bloated sense of entitlement. Mostly, you're risking other people's money. And, mostly, you're buying up existing companies, which you then cannibalize by firing workers and selling off corporate parts to fatten your take. Nothing noble about it. This is Jim Hightower saying, income is income, and the super rich deserve no special tax break because they make their money from money. As Warren Buffett has asked, why should billionaire investors like him pay a lower tax rate than our receptionists do or our cleaning ladies? It's a question of fundamental fairness.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Bolivian President Evo Morales has ordered a senior U.S. diplomat to leave the country. Francisco Martinez is the second secretary of the U.S. Embassy in La Paz to be expelled from the country in the past 6 months. In September, Morales expelled then-U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg after accusing him of conspiracy. Several officials from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration have also been expelled after being accused of espionage and funding of criminal groups seeking to undermine the government. Evo Morales also stirred up controversy after he transferred thousands of hectares of land seized from wealthy owners to poor indigenous people. Morales said the move would end human rights violations against indigenous people and discourage people from putting profit first. The previous landowners have been accused of employing workers in poor conditions and misusing the land. Morales said in a ceremony yesterday, "Private property will always be respected." But he wants people who are not interested in equality to change their thinking and focus more on a country than currency. Morales is Bolivia's first indigenous president and has strong support from the country's indigenous groups.
For the first time in El Salvador's history, the left-wing FMLN party has declared victory in the presidential elections. Shortly after El Salvador's new president-elect Mauricio Funes announced the win, the right-wing Arena Party candidate Rodrigo Avila conceded defeat. The Portland Central American Solidarity Committee has been a chapter of CISPAS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People in El Salvador, since 1980. 10 Portlanders joined the PCASC delegation to observe the historic elections in El Salvador. Trillium Shannon spoke with some of the delegates as the results came in last night.
You are right now in El Salvador. The election results are coming in. Give us the latest update. What's going on there?
There are fireworks going off in the sky. People are absolutely out dancing and celebrating in the streets. There is cheering everywhere. While the official results may not have been finalized right at this moment, or maybe actually they just have been. It looks like it has been. The FMLN has won the presidency of El Salvador, finally. They have Funes on television right now giving a speech as the president-elect. That's what it looks like to me. and people are just celebrating. I mean, they've been celebrating for some time. It's really looked like they've been strongly ahead in the polls. They took all the really big places. The Salvadoran people have been struggling for 20 years to just in this process to try and get their voice heard and have a legitimate place to make change within the government, and it's finally here, and they have worked so hard. And if you could have seen how organized people were today and how amazingly everyone was coming through, it was one of the most inspirational things I've ever seen in my life. it's really phenomenal. And Funes' speech right now is talking about cooperation and respect and listening to, you know, both parties and inclusivity in the government. But he's also just really congratulating everyone who has worked so hard and had the courage to come out today in the face of all the crazy craziness that made up this mess of an electoral campaign and all of the fear and threats that were in the media and people who stood up to that and came out and had the courage to vote today. I've never been so proud to stand in solidarity ever in my life.
It's amazing. And are you with any of the other delegates from Portland at this time, or are people all at different polling stations?
We were all over the country today, and so several of us have made it back in, and so there are a few other people here from Portland. Some of them are still out. They are, you know, 3 or 4 hours away. They're up in Las Cabanas, and they're spread all over, really. So Portland was all over this country and representing in a really beautiful and meaningful way.
Burke Stansberry, executive director of CISPIS, said that continued solidarity in El Salvador is needed following the election.
Despite this great victory, we also recognize that the battle has really just begun, because now we have the challenge of defending the victory and working with our partners here in El Salvador. And it is a huge challenge, because we know there's going to be a counterattack by the right wing. They're going to do everything they can to prevent the FMLN and this new government from being successful. And so it's our responsibility as a solidarity force in the United States to continue supporting and working with this revolutionary movement here in El Salvador and throughout Latin America in order to really see this better world that we all want to bring about.
This is Claire from Portland, and I just wanted to say it's so amazing to be down here and be part of this historic moment, and I just want to say thank you to everybody in Portland and all over the country that's with us in international solidarity. This is truly one of the most amazing moments of my life, and I'm so honored to be down here.
Claire, can you tell us how the week was leading up until now? I know that there were some ups and downs in the week.
Yeah, I mean, we came down with really high hopes, and seeing some of the news got us down because there was so much propaganda and just a lot of sort of iffy things going on in the media. And, you know, there was those statements made by the 5 Republican congressmen, and we were really nervous that those were going to have a big impact. So when the State Department came out and declared neutrality, we sort of knew that was going to counteract everything. So it's just sort of been an emotional roller coaster, because it was a really dirty campaign, you know, with all sorts of fear tactics used. So we didn't know how that was going to affect the people, but it seems like they're tired of that, because they've been dealing with that for almost 20 years. So.
And now it's time to celebrate.
It is. So, yeah, we'll be probably up all night.
Reporting for KBOO News, with last night's election results from El Salvador, I'm Trillium Shannon.
Today marks the 6th anniversary of the death of peace activist Rachel Corrie in the Gaza Strip. Corrie was a recent graduate of Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and 23 years old when she was killed. She was engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience, standing in front of a Palestinian home to stop Israeli forces from demolishing it. An Israeli soldier ran her down with an armored bulldozer, then backed over her body several times. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Cindy Corrie, Rachel's mother, who's still pushing for an investigation of her daughter's killing 6 years after her death.
What is the current status of the investigation? I know that you had called for the U.S. government to push the Israeli government for an investigation. Has that happened?
There were initially in 2003, there was a command report that came out quickly after Rachel was killed. It basically blamed her for being there, took no responsibility. There was a military police investigation. Our State Department felt that there was the potential for that to be a good investigation, but the position of the U.S. government, which has been stated on several occasions now, remains that there has not been a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's case, and this is the 6th anniversary. They also, the last written communication that we had pertaining to that came March of last year, in which a high-level official in the State Department said that they continue to ask the Israeli government for questions and for answers and accountability in Rachel's case, but they either get inadequate answers or no replies at all. I hope that maybe, again, with the new administration, that there will be a different approach to that. I think we've seen in the UK, for example, with the killings of Tom Herndo and James Miller, who were killed on the same border, there's been a very different result in the UK, I think, because the British government has brought more pressure to bear than the US government has. I frankly feel a lot of concern about our government not responding more strongly to Rachel's case, because I think that it creates, it helps to encourage the impunity that clearly exists within the Israeli military, and I think only contributes to the kinds of that occurred to Palestinians during the recent attacks in Gaza. I hope that there will be, you know, a continued effort to address Rachel's case.
Could you just talk about what you think the significance is today on the sixth anniversary of Rachel's death, what hope there is for potential peace in the region?
Craig and I actually have just come from Gaza. We went with the Code Pink delegation that consisted of about 58 people. I have to say that the devastation that we saw in northern Gaza, throughout Gaza really, was very discouraging. But I was really struck this time by how a way of life continues there. There were women still working in the fields, harvesting. I could see happening. I could see the sheep and the goats being herded. Children were going to school again, and the resilience of the Palestinian people under such really unimaginably difficult circumstances, I think, is really inspiring to me. So I find hope in that. I want to believe that my government is going to take a stand about the atrocities that have occurred in Gaza. And also recently, Craig and I were terribly dismayed to hear the news. An activist in the West Bank from California, Tristan Anderson, who was very, very seriously injured on Friday in a protest in Aleem. And I really hope that our government leaders will take a stand about this and demand that in whatever way that it needs to happen, that there's investigation and accountability for what's happened in Gaza and for what's happened to people at Nalin. There are also four Palestinians who have been killed there in the last 8 months in nonviolent protests.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Cindy Corey, the mother of slain peace activist Rachel Corey, who was killed 6 years ago today. And again, this is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The human rights group Amnesty International has called on the U.S. government to suspend U.S. aid to Israel pending an investigation for human rights violations. This call is unprecedented by the Human Rights Watch group and comes in the wake of a massive invasion of the Gaza Strip by Israeli forces in January. But the Obama administration has not responded to the call, and some analysts say that this indicates there will be little change between the Bush Doctrine and Obama's policy toward Israel. Stephen Zunis is the chair of the Middle East Studies Department at the San Francisco University.
Well, I've seen some changes, though, to be sure. I think the absence of mentioning U.S. aid to Israel in the draft 2010 budget that Obama put forward a few weeks ago, I think it's more an indication that U.S. aid to Israel is becoming more and more controversial and that he doesn't want to advertise it. But I don't think there's any question there's going to still be billions of dollars of unconditional military aid, though there are some indications that he will not be increasing aid as was planned. And Hillary Clinton's recent trip indicated that there may be a slight shift and that she was willing to raise concerns about certain Israeli policies. And at the same time, it was quite mild. For example, the destruction of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories is recognized as a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention in terms of the obligations of belligerent occupying powers, as well as a violation of a number of specific UN Security Council resolutions, and all that Hillary Clinton could say was that it was unhelpful. So while saying it's unhelpful is more than the Bush administration ever did, it is still pretty clear that if the United States is going to really try to resolve the conflict, that they need to be more direct in challenging these Israeli policies, which are not only violations of international humanitarian law, but are ultimately not in Israel's long-term interest either.
That was Professor Stephen Zunis from the University of San Francisco speaking on President Obama's policy toward Israel.
And now some more news from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, March 16, 2009. The Israeli army allows supplies into the Gaza Strip whilst attacking civilians in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian civilian was reported injured during an Israeli settler attack on Monday in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. A 24-year-old Palestinian woman sustained moderate wounds after she was attacked by settlers, medical sources reported. The young woman's family reported that she was on her way back home in Hebron city when settlers from nearby illegal settlement threw stones at her. The residents say that the settlers attacked them frequently, sometimes aided by the military. During pre-dawn invasions targeting other West Bank communities, the Israeli military kidnapped 11 Palestinian civilians on Monday, local sources reported. The attacks were reported in Nablus, Jenin, Ramallah and Bethlehem, sources said. The Israeli military opened two border crossings leading into Gaza on Monday to allow food supplies into the besieged region. Local sources said that the army opened Karim Abu Salem and Al-Mintar crossings in the southern and central Gaza Strip. It was stated that a total of 110 trucks loaded with food supplies were allowed into the coastal region, in addition to 6 trucks of cooking gas and 10 trucks of gasoline to generate electricity. The Gaza Strip has been under siege from the Israeli army since June 2007, allowing only limited supplies of humanitarian aid into Gaza, leaving the 1.5 million Palestinians living there on the verge of starvation. Also in Gaza, Palestinian sources reported on Monday that unmanned Israeli planes fired missiles at a group of people gathered in Jabalia town in the northern part of the Gaza Strip late Sunday night. Doctors reported that one man sustained critical injuries due to the attack. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Mary Arthur and Cassandra Nora.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is special thanks to reporters and all of the gang. Our engineer tonight is, in fact, Rebecca Ney. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on the KABU website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. I'm Ani.
And I'm Eddie Greenlee. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe and Joe host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, host Per Fogering speaks with Pepe Escobar, reporter for the Asia Times, about Afghanistan and the Great Game. At 9:30, the guest is economics professor and author Richard Wolff on Capitalism Hits the Fan, the Economic Meltdown. at 10. It's news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta on Air Cascadia. At 10:15, you can hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts talks with Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center directors about a possible cutoff in funding from parks and recreation. And Jamie Hampton of Body Vox Dance tells us about the Foot Opera Files. At 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Mark Andres about his current work at the Augen de Soto Gallery. The exhibition is called Painting in Time. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker-Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News.
From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, March 16, 2009. Marxist rebels-turned-political party, the FMLN, sweep the polls in El Salvador. The Red Cross details the torture of prisoners under the Bush administration. And the Obama administration announces plans to help small businesses during the Great Recession. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Madagascar today, dozens of soldiers and armored tanks forcibly entered one of the nation's presidential compounds and ordered those inside to vacate the building. This after opposition leader Andry Rajoelina called for both the resignation of the nation's president and his arrest on charges of high treason. President Ravalo Manan, who was not in the palace at the time, has said he will not resign, while Rajoelina has refused to participate in a referendum. Also today, the Indian Ocean Islands' new army chief, who assumed his position last week after staging a mutiny, declared his support for the opposition. Thousands of Tamil Tigers supporters demonstrated in Brussels today, calling on European Union foreign ministers meeting there to send observers to the war zone and to bring an end to what they call the genocide in Sri Lanka. Also today, the United Nations accused the LTTE rebels of forcibly recruiting a UN staffer. FSRN's Punia Manikavasagam has more.
The United Nations accusations come 2 days after top government medical official in the area announced all surgeries have been stopped due to a severe shortage of important medicines, including anesthetic and blood bags. Dr. Ture Raja Varadaraja said the medical staff was using bed sheets for bandages, while sticks were used as splints to treat fractured limbs. The closure of the hospital would put the lives of thousands of sick and injured people in the conflict zone at extreme risk. The military said on Monday the troops were within a kilometer of a no-fire zone in a fast-shrinking rebel territory. The government accuses the rebels of using some 70,000 civilians trapped in the conflict as human shields, but the International Red Cross puts the number of trapped civilians closer to 150,000. Yesterday alone, the military says that more than 1,000 have fled, nearly half of them are children. Although the rebels have not responded to the UN's accusation, they have been denying the charges of civilian and child recruitments. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ponneya Manikavasagam.
After 146 years of operation, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer has announced that tomorrow's print edition will be its last. From Seattle, Mark Taylor Canfield.
The Hearst Corporation announced today that it is closing the print edition of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer after 9 years of operating at a financial loss. The newspaper, established in 1863, was put up for sale in January of this year, but no potential buyers stepped forward. The Post-Intelligencer has been run by a joint operating agreement with the Seattle Times since 1983, with both papers maintaining separate news and editorial departments. According to the Hearst Corporation, the Seattle PI experienced $14 million in losses last year. The paper plans to continue limited news operations through their website, but 150 employees will lose their jobs. The Seattle Times, which has also been experiencing major financial losses, will remain the only major daily newspaper in Seattle. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
Bolivian President Evo Morales took from the rich and gave to the poor over the weekend, saying the move would stop human rights abuses of indigenous citizens. Morales gave the deeds to nearly 40,000 hectares of land to the Guarani people and another 17,000 to the communal lands of origin. Morales said that while continuing to respect private property rights, this redistribution of land is the beginning of the end of giant property holdings in Bolivia. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
New details are emerging on the Bush administration's use of torture. A leaked Red Cross document describes incidents of torture in graphic detail. The organization's use of the word torture implies that the Red Cross believes that the interrogation practices violated international law. Meanwhile, President Obama made another move to distance himself from Bush-era terror policies, but critics say it may just be cosmetic. Tanya Snyder reports.
The International Committee of the Red Cross didn't mean for their document to be released to the public. Spokesperson Bernard Barrett says they regret that information attributed to an ICRC document was leaked in this way.
We have access to these places on the understanding that we're not going to go public and discuss these things publicly. And at the same time, if we want to bring about change, we have to develop sort of a relationship of confidence, if you will, with the people in charge.
The document was quoted extensively in a New York Review of Books article by Professor Mark Danner, dated April 9, 2009. The voices quoted are those of the detainees themselves, people being held at the so-called black site prisons operated by the CIA in other countries. The detainees' stories of abuse led the Red Cross to affirm that the interrogation methods used by the CIA constitute torture. Tom Parker was a counter-terrorist officer in the UK for 6 years. Now he's a policy director at Amnesty International. He says the document is significant because the ICRC is the leading institution on the planet investigating detainee treatment.
These are the people who police the Geneva Conventions, and when they throw around and use words like torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, they know what they're talking about. Both of those things amount to war crimes.
The Red Cross report was sent to the General Counsel of the CIA 2 years ago and was meant to be read only by senior government officials. It is not meant to provide evidence for prosecution of anyone responsible for violating international law. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has distanced itself from the Bush policy of labeling detainees enemy combatants. The Justice Department filed court papers Friday outlining Obama's standards for holding terrorism suspects without court review. The new standards limit executive authority in determining the status of detainees and the way they are tried.
What changed on Friday was absolutely nothing.
Stephen Abraham worked in U.S. military intelligence for decades, even sitting on combatant status review tribunals established by the Bush administration. He was the first such officer to protest the administration's policies of indefinite detention, first internally and then publicly. He serves on the Constitution Project's Liberty and Security Committee.
You're still describing precisely the same people who have been subjected to this treatment, and you're still adhering to a definition that can apply to anyone who engages in any conduct that tends to injure this nation, its people, its economy.
The phrase enemy combatant refers to an opponent in war. Some critics, like Amnesty's Tom Parker, think the term was inappropriate because it gave too much credit to terrorists.
And so you're elevating the people that you're fighting against to the stature of soldiers instead of treating them as criminals. This is why the Bush administration also used the term unlawful combatant, which hasn't been mentioned in this statement, because that, you know, reflects more accurately this idea that these people are not fighting fair, that they don't carry their weapons openly, they don't wear uniforms. But enemy combatants are a term of art that is used for one army fighting another army.
The new standards also call for detention only of people who provided substantial assistance to the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups. Abraham says the inclusion of the word is meaningless.
You ask the question, what does substantial mean? It's really in the eye of the beholder. It's an undefinable term. In other words, as the government itself suggested in its briefing on Friday, let us decide on a case-by-case basis who meets this definition. Which is to say, it's not really a defining term then. It's a comfort word.
Attorney General Eric Holder has signaled that more changes will be coming as the new administration works to undo policies that were widely condemned as violations of international law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
AIG's decision to award massive bonuses may result in a subpoena. New York's Attorney General says the insurance giant's CEO must make public the names of those getting bonuses or risk a subpoena for the information. AIG has received $170 billion in bailout funds, and the company's decision to award bonuses has also garnered President Obama's attention. He's urging Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to block the move.
I mean, how do they justify this outrage to the taxpayers who are keeping the company afloat? In the last 6 months, AIG has received substantial sums from the U.S. Treasury. And I've asked Secretary Geithner to use that leverage and pursue every single legal avenue to block these bonuses.
AIG's derivative traders are the ones responsible for credit default swaps, which brought AIG into financial instability. The company has paid them $165 million in bonuses. President Obama and the Treasury Department also released plans today to assist small businesses in getting loans. In an effort to reduce fees and gain access, Treasury Secretary Geithner put pressure on banks to make money available. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The tightened credit markets have had severe consequences for small businesses. President Obama outlined the problem.
So, community banks cannot bring in the funds necessary to provide as many loans. And as a result, we've seen a precipitous drop in lending to small business. The SBA typically guarantees $20 billion in loans annually, but this year lending may fall below $10 billion. Even businesses with impeccable credit can't access loans.
His plan is a combination of spending government dollars to boost capital and guaranteeing loans to boost confidence. To provide capital, the plan targets the secondary market, where many small business loans are made and resold. The government will purchase $15 billion of SBA, or Small Business Administration, loan-backed securities. The banks will have more incentive to start making loans because the government will guarantee up to 90% of loans made through the SBA. Also, small businesses will see lower fees for obtaining loans. David Beck, Policy Director for Center for Community Self-Help, which lends to low-income borrowers, says the plan is a good mix of solutions.
I think this is a big step in the right direction. We think it will unfreeze credit markets to small businesses.
Banks are also pleased with the plan as their loans will be guaranteed. James Ballantine is a senior vice president at the American Bankers Association.
I think anything at this point helps, and these seem very helpful. Clearly, a lot of things have been tried, a lot of things will be tried, and we'll probably see more in the future. Each announcement gets better, and this one provides a great advance for businesses and for the bankers that are out there trying to serve the business needs.
But the announcement also provided a stern message to banks. Here's Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner.
Credit is essential to economic recovery, and we need our nation's banks to go the extra mile in keeping credit lines in place on reasonable terms for viable businesses. When banks individually pull back out of a sense of prudence and caution, the collective impact of those actions will make the economy weaker and make each individual bank worse off. Because by pulling back on credit, you push businesses to pull back, and this dynamic can feed on itself.
Lenders and bankers appear pleased, but small businesses, the intended recipients, are concerned. The program helps small businesses that obtain loans through the Small Business Administration. William Dennis, senior research fellow at the National Federation of Independent Business, which represents small businesses in all 50 states, says only 1% of small businesses receive loans through the SBA.
And in some ways, it's kind of discouraging because they go back to the same old 7A loan program or the same old small business programs for the Small Business Administration rather than doing things like trying to use the community banks and things of that nature who have many, many more small business customers. And
We're much more in tune with small business owners.
Dennis also says loan assistance does not address the number one problem, hurting business because of low sales and lack of customers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
After a two-year combined effort by human rights groups and migrant workers, the Lebanese Ministries of Labor and Social Justice promised to enact a unified contract for migrant domestic workers, a community that numbers more than 200,000 in Lebanon and are still legally considered servants rather than employees, Simba Russo reports.
The new demands agreed upon by a steering committee will be included in a new contract and could be a step forward for migrant rights in Lebanon. It also marks the first time that the employee and employer would read the same contract in their own language. Nadim Houri is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
So the contract, for example, will say that the positive thing, the migrants will, the maximum hours of work per day are supposed to be 10 hours of work per day. A migrant will have to be guaranteed 8 hours of rest, continuous rest at night. It guarantees 24 hours off per week. Now, it does not guarantee that these 24 hours will be to go out. This remains to be negotiated between the employer and employee.
Migrant workers who have taken on a lead role in their communities, along with groups such as Human Rights Watch, presented the contract to the government ministries. The contract would also tackle the problem of salary. Due to lack of protection for female migrants by their governments and host countries, many freelance domestic workers have created social networking communities by providing shelter for those that run away and speaking out along with civil and human rights groups. Amy is a domestic worker from Madagascar. She came to Lebanon 11 years ago.
Sometimes I wonder why I put myself in this area, but it's very hard. The consulate before is very bad. That's why I was very much involved before. Because I see my people, my countrymen, they are in a deep distress.
Workers are therefore still demanding a new decree that will increase the regulation of placement agencies, which at the moment are not accountable to anyone. They also want the ministry to amend the labor law to include migrant domestic workers under Article 6 to be considered employees rather than servants, which is their current status, one that does not grant them any rights or protection whatsoever. Angelique is a domestic worker from Sudan who came to Lebanon to escape war in her country. Daily, she fears the possibility of imprisonment due to her status as a refugee.
We have need in terms of education. We have need in terms of health care. The most need is to have protection, legal protection, to be given legal rights.
There's also the issue of physical abuse and suicides, which is difficult to address because of isolation and the lack of social protection. The Caritas Migrant Center is one of few organizations in Lebanon that offers a 24-hour counseling hotline and shelter for victims of abuse.
There are so many who run away for legitimate reasons, but they don't have a place to go, and they are being taken advantage of. The shelters are not enough.
Although this is a major step to achieving basic rights for domestic workers in Lebanon, the women still feel there is a major issue that needs to be addressed in the contract, that they should not have their passports taken by their employers, but should be able to provide them with a photocopy. Naime Pelo is a domestic worker from Kenya.
They are caught in the streets because they don't have papers, because the employers don't let them keep the passports.
But the absence of protection for their nationals has prompted key labor source countries to restrict travel to Lebanon. Last year, Ethiopia officially banned its citizens from coming to work in Lebanon, while since November 2007, migrant Philippine workers are only legally permitted to travel to Lebanon if paid a minimum of $400 per month. Sri Lanka is now considering banning women migrant domestic workers from going to many countries in the Middle East, including Lebanon, starting in 2009, according to Human Rights Watch. This is Simba Russo reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Beirut.
A devastating flood hit the northern Indian state of Bihar last year, displacing millions of people. 6 months on, most of the displaced have not been able to return to their homes. Hundreds of miles away in New Delhi, many of them are now on hunger strike, demanding immediate rehabilitation. Bismila Gilani has the story.
About 200 men and women clamor for attention near the Parliament House in New Delhi. They are the survivors of the floods that wreaked havoc in the northern state of Bihar in August 2008. Many of them lost their homes, cattle, fields and all other possessions in the tragedy, but haven't yet received any help from the government. 38-year-old Santosh Singh is a laborer from Sahrsa district of Bihar.
The government did not fulfill its duty. They only made promises and did a little bit of relief work in the beginning and then forgot everything. Now the situation is even worse than it was at the time of the floods. Those who lost their homes had no shelter. A large part of the agricultural land is no longer farmable and people have no food. It's a starvation-like situation in North Bihar and many people are now migrating to other places.
Bihar, one of India's most impoverished states, has always been prone to floods. The Kosi River is a lifeline to the state's more than 80 million population, which is heavily dependent on agriculture. But the river turns into a source of death and destruction every year, and the devastation caused by floods last year was unparalleled. Nearly 2,000 people were killed and more than 3 million displaced when the river breached its eastern embankment in Nepal and changed its course, drowning hundreds of villages and towns. Social activist Devchand Vishwatma blames the government for the tragedy.
It wasn't a natural calamity, it was a man-made disaster. When you build a large embankment and it collapses, the destruction will be at a larger scale. This time, the erosion was noticed earlier, but for 10 days, the government did nothing. It was a case of gross negligence. Even now, the Kosi project is being built in such a way that will cause further problems.
In 1954, a 22-kilometer-long embankment was built on both sides of the river under a treaty between India and Nepal. India had taken responsibility of its maintenance. Most of the affected families are still living in the makeshift relief camps, but with no access to clean water, adequate food, and proper medical care, many have been falling prey to various diseases. Pila Ram is member of Ekta Parishad, an NGO helping in the relief work.
People were saved from drowning, but they are not getting the medical care they need. The wells and other water sources in the area are filled with water that came from the floods and had even dead bodies in it, but still people have been drinking the same water. Because the government did not make any arrangements for safe water, diseases like malaria and diarrhea are widespread.
While the protesters in New Delhi have attracted support from many individuals and groups, the government has not yet responded. The protesters have threatened to prolong their hunger strike for an indefinite period if their demand for immediate rehabilitation is not met. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
And that wraps up today's newscast from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Aura Bogado.
And you are listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, and streaming 24 hours a day at www.kboo.fm. Stay tuned for Labor Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by SEIU Local 503, OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by SEIU Local 503, OPEU, whose mission...
This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO, your community radio station in Portland. Labor Radio is the only program of its kind in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm your host, Kevin Card, your friendly neighborhood letter carrier, and boy, was it nice walking out in the rain today. And we're going to talk about that rain and about how important it is to my guest tonight, because tonight I am totally excited. After a couple of years of haranguing him, I finally have Ben Cannon, who represents Oregon House District Number 46, which runs from the Banfield kind of south, takes in, I believe, part of Laurelhurst and scoots all the way out to my neighborhood. And the reason I know that is because a couple summers ago, this young man comes walking up to me, walking through my yard, and we ended up striking a conversation. And lo and behold, he was running for the House, and here he is. Ben Cannon was reelected to a second term in the Oregon House last November, and in 2009, this session, he chairs the Environment and Water Committee. He also serves on the Health Care Committee, the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Ben is a native of the Mount Tabor neighborhood of Southeast Portland, a graduate of Washington University, a Rhodes Scholar. At Oxford University in England, he conducted research on U.S. and international education policy, while he received degrees in philosophy, politics, and economics. Boy, don't we need people with that these days. And he also, in comparative and international education. We will be taking your phone calls in the second half of the program after Ben and I get to talk about a few things. The number down here at KBOO is 503-231-8187, but give us a chance to talk a little. Ben Cannon, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm glad to be here.
It is great to have you here. So tell us about what kind of an exciting term we're having here. You folks have been kind of under the ringers for a while here. You started off dealing with an $800-plus hole in the current biennium, which we are going to finish up here in just about 3 months, I believe.
That's right.
And so you had to plug that hole, and now you're going to be looking at a something even bigger in the next biennium.
Yeah, we are we're in uncharted water, Kevin, because, as you know, our state faces just really unprecedented challenges with the economy and challenges that mean that state government has a big hole in its budget for 09-11, and we're working on those budgets now. I sit on one of the budget subcommittees, as you mentioned. We're hearing from the agencies and trying to figure out how we're going to fill this gap, which is at least $3.3 billion for 09-11, but probably more like $4 or $5 billion below what will be necessary to just continue current state service levels. So on a, you know, $15, $16 billion budget, that $4 or $5 billion is huge. That's, you know, close to a third of what we would need in order to sort of fully fund the current programs.
Well, let's talk about this. One thing that Ben Cannon does great, he has on his website, if you go to his website for through the House of Oregon, you will find out that Ben has some interactive videos there in which he talks about the Oregon state budget and what we have in the way of discretionary spending and mandatory spending. And I think that for most people in Oregon, they really have a hard time wrapping their arms around and understanding just what the state budget is and how you, the legislators, are charged with managing it. So can you explain what the budget is and the different pieces of it?
Yeah, I'll try to do that as simply as possible. It's tough because it's a big budget. We're looking at about $40 billion total that the state spends every 2 years on everything from transportation to health care to schools to public safety. But a big chunk of that $40 billion is in what we call dedicated funds. So it's not things that the legislature has a whole lot of discretion over. These include things like federal payments that we get for health care for low-income people through the Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan program. Right. So that's part of that $40 billion, and it's part that the legislature helps direct, and the legislature helps shape the Oregon Health Plan. But that's money we get from the federal government to spend on health insurance for low income people. So we don't, you know, we can't go and spend that money on education, for instance. That's a big chunk of the $40 billion. Another big chunk of it is in taxes and fees on gas, car licenses and registration. That's also dedicated funding, and we spend it on road construction and maintenance projects primarily. Once you peel off all those dedicated funds, typically paid by fees or from the federal government, you're left with this kind of $15, $16 billion in a biennium in a two-year period that's the general fund. And that's what the media reports on. That's what there's a lot of interest in, because that's what the legislature can spend any old way it wants. We decide how to spend that $15, $16 billion. The federal government doesn't tell us. It's not dedicated by law for particular programs. And we spend the largest chunk of that on education. So education, K through 12, community colleges, and higher ed constitute more than half of our general fund spending. So, you know, something on the order of, and these are very rough, but something in the area of sort of $8 billion per biennium that we spend on education. The other big chunks are human services, so everything from our foster care system to senior care, nursing home care, as well as so that's chunk two, the human services, and the third is public safety. So, you know, the prisons that we build, the justice system that we help administer, that those three categories, education, human services, and public safety, constitute sort of 95% of our general fund spending. So when people talk about budget cuts, they're talking about cuts to the general fund, and they're talking about cuts that will affect kids in school, that will affect seniors receiving nursing home care or food assistance. They're talking about cuts to public safety. It's really in those three categories that we'll be making cuts this year.
And how does that work? How do the cuts get? I mean, I imagine that there are probably busloads of school children and other folks going down to Salem on a daily basis to try and say, don't cut me, even though something has to give.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we have a budget writing committees. I serve on one of them that will be trying to cobble together a balanced budget. And unlike the federal government, the reason why we have to go, you know, cuts have to be part of the conversation, unfortunately, is because unlike the federal government, we can't borrow money, we can't print money. We can borrow it, but for very limited purposes, typically, you know, capital and construction. So that means we have to run these balanced budgets. Our revenues have to equal expenditures. So we do have a few options, right? So we can raise revenue. We can increase taxes and fees to try to cover the budget shortfall. We can make cuts. And because of the good work of Congress and the Obama administration, we also have federal money to spend, the sort of discretionary money that's coming as part of the federal economic stimulus package. And finally, we have the state's rainy day funds to draw on during this budgeting process. So our options include raising new revenue, spending one-time rainy day fund and federal stimulus money, and doing cuts. And the reality is we're going to do some combination of all three of those things in order to come up with a balanced budget for the next biennium. It's not reasonable or feasible for us to raise the $4 or $5 billion of new revenue that would be required. There are lots of ideas, many of which I'll support, about how to increase taxes to cover it, but we're not going to get the entire way through revenue increases, nor are we going to make $4 or $5 billion in cuts, because we're going to get some revenue and we're going to spend probably just about all, if not all, of both the federal stimulus money and our state's rainy day funds in order to come up with a balanced budget in June, and then hope that the economy doesn't get even worse than we thought, and we're back, in which case we'd be back in special session during the biennium trying to rebalance these budgets, which was, as you mentioned, our first task this session when we had to rebalance the 07-09 budget.
Well, Ben, this is your second trip around the block, so to speak, with the legislature in dealing with these kind of issues. I think a lot of Oregonians, I went to a town hall meeting you had in my neighborhood, in February, I think, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And folks, this was just a little bakery, and the room was filled with, probably about 20 or 30 people. And I have never seen a group of Oregonians so willing to raise taxes in my life. And I just I stand off to the side and I'm saying, I've been living in this state for close to 30 years, and it was always less taxes. But this group of folks, and I tell you, I live in a blue-collar neighborhood, and this group of folks, they were all about raising revenue. They were all about the corporate minimum tax. They were all about looking at increasing the taxes on cigarettes and beer and stuff like that. So what do you think? What are you hearing? What is the legislature hearing on the revenue side of it? Because I do think that Oregonians are starting to think a little bit more about the things they value, especially when it comes to education and public safety. What are you hearing from your constituents about that?
Well, that's right. I think what you saw at that event reflects the kind of input I've received from my neighbors and constituents over the last 2 years. Every single time I have one of those conversations, we end up spending the majority of time talking about raising revenue, because I think many Oregonians, as you put it, have come to understand the value of the services that the state provides, and frankly, the history that Oregon has experienced over the last couple of decades, starting, with Measure 5 and the limit on local property taxes and what that meant for our schools. And then really the movement away from corporate taxation. I mean, there was a point in this state's history where corporations sort of paid their share. It wasn't 50% of the total revenue, but it was somewhere in the order of 18, 20, 25%. That's scaled back to below 10%. So there's a real interest in restoring some of the equity between the personal and corporate taxpayer. So those conversations are very much alive in the legislature, and I'm glad to say we're in the position with Democrats in a majority of both chambers and the governor's office to be having some real candid conversations about Oregon's history with revenue and exploring many of the options that are on the table. And the revenue committee has got something like 30 or 40 bills that would raise revenue. We're not going to pass all those. our leadership and sort of House Democrats are committed to passing a increase to the corporate minimum. We're committed to passing new sort of taxes and fees associated, or increases in taxes and fees associated with transportation. So probably a gas tax increase, maybe driver's license registration fees as well. And we're committed to the provider tax in order to expand Oregon Health Plan for low-income children and adults. So we're going to do that, and then there are a whole host of other things that we're looking at, not all of which we'll do. I mean, we understand Oregonians are already feeling pinched, and any taxes, any additional revenue we raise has to conform to principles of basic fairness. It has to conform with progressivity principles. It has to be based on someone's ability to pay. It can't undermine the desire to, you know, or the need to develop and maintain jobs in the state. So, there are balancing tests on all of those revenue increases. But I'm happy to say that there's a lot on the table, and we'll be exploring all of them thoroughly and in a position to deliver the votes on good ones. Again, it's not going to get us all the way there. It's not going to get us the $4 or $5 billion, but we will be exploring, and we already are exploring quite a few options.
Well, you just said something that I'm not familiar with, and this is the health care provider tax.
Yeah.
And this is targeted towards increasing revenue for a select group, I take it.
This is a great deal because there's $1 billion sitting in Washington, D.C. with Oregon's name on it. This is federal dollars that are available to states that meet the requirements for a state match on Medicaid. Oregon is not fully taking advantage of that federal match. It's those $1 billion are sitting in Washington. If we raise something like $600 million, the state chips in, or the federal government chips in $1 billion, and instead of having $600 million to spend on low-income health care, we have $1.6 billion. That's a great deal for Oregon. We will get that money by assessing a tax on providers of health care, basically hospitals. And, you know, we know about the profitability of hospitals. We also know about the costs that they incur when they treat uninsured Oregonians in emergency rooms. Of course, ERs are sort of the backstop of our health care system for the uninsured, and they are the most expensive place possible to deliver care. So we know this is a good deal for hospitals when we help shift those people out of the emergency room, put them on Medicaid plans where the hospitals will get reimbursed for services using this $1 billion that we're able to draw in from the federal government. We also create a whole lot of jobs in the healthcare industry. This is an economic stimulus. It's a shot in the arm for Oregon. There's going to be a big challenging conversation about this issue in Salem, but we're going to deliver the votes, I believe, on some kind of significant provider tax that helps add, I'm forgetting on the exact figures, but on the order of 100,000 kids and 60,000 adults to the Oregon Health Plan. So making a pretty significant dent in the rate of uninsured in Oregon.
Well, that sounds like something most working folks could definitely support, because
absolutely,
those of us who actually get health care through our employers are, in effect, subsidizing the uninsured. Our premiums have to cover those folks down the road via our hospital costs. So that health care provider tax has pretty good support.
Yeah, it is a high priority item for the House Democratic Caucus. I believe the Senate D's as well. We're in negotiations with the hospital community on how to make sure we get it right. I expect that we will see that cross the governor's desk.
Now, as far as the corporate minimum, this seems to be the perennial boogeyman in Oregon, where we talk about, what is it, $10? Is that the minimum? Oregon minimum tax for a corporation is $10?
Yeah, and it hasn't been changed since the 1920s, and before it was $10, it was $20. So it was actually reduced in the 75 years ago, and it hasn't gone up since.
What are the thoughts on that?
Well, there's a very robust debate about the corporate minimum. I mean, bottom line, we need to restore some equity in the system, make sure that corporations are paying their share. You know, structuring this in a way that it doesn't penalize small businesses that are not profitable is challenging, right? We want to make sure that we get folks like, you know, Nike and PGE, major corporations in this state, to be paying more than $10. I mean, that's the goal. But if you, you know, if you were to convert this $10 corporate minimum into a, you know, $500,000 corporate minimum or $5 million corporate minimum, obviously you would have a terrible impact on small, unprofitable businesses that are paying, you know, the $10 now. So we're working on ways to do this, to tier it, to sort of stair step it in a way that makes sure it's not overly burdensome for, in particular, smaller, less profitable corporations. It's a very robust conversation. There's some of us who want to make sure that we don't lose this opportunity to really do the right thing around corporate taxation, which means more than a corporate minimum increase that, you know, generates something on this order of 60, 80, 100 million, but rather a proposal, a plan on corporate taxation that gets us closer to that degree of equity that we had in one point in this state, and something on the order of, you know, the hundreds of millions, not 60, 80 million. That may require tools beyond the corporate minimum. The corporate minimum itself may not be able to carry all that weight.
Like maybe a gross receipts tax for certain corporations that have a certain revenue threshold or something like
that?
Yeah,
I mean, that's certainly one option. A business franchise tax, such as they use in Texas. I mean, there are varieties of ways that one can tax corporations. We're exploring those.
Well, let's talk about two taxes that have been really big in the news in the last couple of weeks, which would directly affect the host of this program. One would be the beer tax, because I, like many Oregonians, like an occasional beer now and then. And it's amazing to me how controversial this tax has become when we're really not talking about a huge amount of revenue. This is not going to balance the Oregon budget. And this is not going to impact, as I was talking to you earlier, Ben, you were quoted in an article today in the Oregonian talking how you spoke about how there have been studies showing very little change in the price of beer when you look at this tax. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let me just put it simply. We have proposed a 15-cent per serving increase in the beer tax. The beer producing community, and in particular our great Oregon craft brewers, have raised the alarm bells about this increase. And they claim that the reason for that is not that they, you know, would never accept a 15-cent increase in the price of beer, but they claim because this is a production excise tax levied on the brewer himself or the importer of beer, that it would produce a, you know, $1.50 to $2 increase in the price of a pint. And if that's its effect, then there's a problem with the tax, right? Because our intent is not to increase the price of a pint of beer by $1.50 or $2. That would undermine demand in a way that would jeopardize the livelihood of our great Oregon brewing industry. I want to say a couple of things in response to that. One is that the vast majority of this revenue would be generated on out-of-state beers. We're not targeting our Oregon industry. This is an excise tax that's paid by the importer of beers if that beer is produced out-of-state. So Coors, Miller, Budweiser, other out-of-state beers would be responsible for 90% or so of the tax. Not only that, we have said repeatedly to Oregon brewers, hey, we'll exempt you from this tax, or we will exempt, you know, the first 150,000 barrels of production from this tax, meaning most Oregon brewers aren't going to pay it. So far, not a lot of interest from them in even that idea, but we're still, you know, trying to explore ways to make this work for our Oregon brewing industry with the knowledge, and in my case, really firm belief and knowledge that my constituents would be happy to pay an extra few cents for beer. And when I throw out the number 15 or 20 cents, they don't blink. Right, that seems like an appropriate price to pay in order to generate $300 million to fully fund addiction services in this state, which is what we've dedicated the money for in our proposal.
Well, that sounds like something this beer drinker could get behind also. The other thing was a bicycle tax. There's a talk about a bike tax, and it was real funny. One of the folks I work with who does not ride a bicycle kind of accosted me with the newspaper a couple of weeks ago and said, what do you think of this bike tax? And he was a little taken aback when I said, well, I'm all for it because I'm out there on the roads all the time and my roads are maintained largely by the cost of fuel in this state. I don't pay anything to maintain roads. when I ride a bicycle. So what are you hearing about that?
Well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this particular proposal is dead on arrival. It's a bike registration fee. It seems to me there's no reason in the world that we should pay that somebody who has five bikes in their basement should pay, you know, $50 a bike. Like, that doesn't make any sense. The concept of ultimately getting to a place where bicyclists are contributing to some part of the infrastructure necessary to maintain, you know, routes for bicyclists makes sense. The issue now is that, you know, cars, automobiles account for, you know, vast kind of social, economic, environmental problems. The bicyclist is helping reduce those. I think it would be pretty awkward to go to the bicycling community and say, here, you help pay the costs associated with traffic, when in fact it's the cyclists who are helping minimize the traffic.
Right.
So long run, yeah, I think we ought to get to that place. That's not where we are today.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Ben, while we have a few minutes left. And you are listening to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Card, and my guest is Ben Cannon, who represents House District 46 here in Oregon. Ben, you are on the Environment and Water Committee. That's a committee you chair. What kind of things are coming up in front of that committee? Is this budget thing just overriding everything else? Is it taking any positive action we could probably expect the legislature to do? Or do you see things that are still approachable?
No, there's the great news is that there is a lot of good stuff that can move forward even in this kind of budget climate. So, for instance, today the Oregon House of Representatives passed a bill that would allow residences to install gray water reuse systems.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
It's currently the case, you know, you can't reuse the water that comes from your sink or your laundry or your shower, no matter what level of treatment or filtration it undergoes. With the passage of this bill, assuming it gets through the Senate and the governor's office, we'll start a process whereby folks will be able to reuse that water under certain conditions. Great piece of legislation, doesn't have big budget impact, and we were able to pass it across the House today.
Well, I know that Local 290, which covers the plumbers and steam fitters in Oregon, actually at their training center have dedicated a portion to that, of how to install gray water systems.
Yep, and this was the last piece, because you can do it in commercial settings, but you couldn't do it in residences.
Right.
That will change as of the passage of this bill.
Great. What else do you see coming out?
So definitely a lot of stuff on water policy. That's part of my committee's purview, but also environmental issues, including, you know, bottle bill. I'm going to be hearing proposed amendments to our Oregon bottle bill this Thursday, so expanding it to additional product, those sports drinks, teas, juices that don't have a deposit on it now. Looking at the 5-cent deposit and saying, you know, is that, you know, 5 cents isn't worth today what it was in 1973 when the bottle bill started. So, you know, we've got lots of good policy to consider. Climate change policy, really adding some teeth to our global warming reduction goals that we passed in 2007, and working with a wide range of stakeholders and the public on ways to do that.
I noticed that you talk about aligning with the Western Climate Initiative, which is a pretty bold step.
Right. The Western Climate Initiative is a group of Western states really led by governors that have committed themselves to aggressive reductions in greenhouse gases. Oregon is among those states, and as I'm sure many of your listeners know, Oregon's governor proposed a, you know, participation in a regional cap and trade system. You know, that conversation is, you know, going very much alive, going on this week. We're talking about how to get there, if we're going to get there. If it's not cap and trade, then what is it? And I'm eager to see that we make sure that Oregon, when the economic rebound occurs, that Oregon, because of its great work on energy efficiency, reducing people's costs, on green jobs, is, you know, poised to be the leader in the national recovery. And I really believe that energy efficiency, water efficiency, reducing, energy use can be a big part of our advantage here.
Well, I'm glad to hear you have some positive outlook about what the legislature is going to be able to accomplish. Today it was announced that Oregon's unemployment rate officially went over 10%, gained a full percentage point. What does the legislature see their role in dealing with this?
It's really unsettling news. These numbers continue to surprise and alarm, and, you know, I suspect they're only getting worse. they will only get worse. We early in this session passed a short-term economic stimulus using state dollars to get construction projects on the ground, ones that could get, you know, could get started right away. We'll be doing the same thing, I suspect, later in the session with a larger stimulus package for 09-11. That's one way we can try to help reverse these trends. But obviously, this is a problem much bigger than Oregon, and much bigger than Oregon's going to be able to solve. And this is a global recession, and we haven't seen anything like it before.
Well, Ben, I look forward to seeing what comes out of this. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to come all the way down to the KBOO studios tonight, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck throughout, and maybe we can have you come back to the station after the session to brag about all the great things that the Oregon legislature was able to accomplish.
I would love to do that. Thanks, Kevin.
And you've been listening to Labor Radio on KBOO. Stay tuned every Monday from 6 to 6:30.
Sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. A Billy fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. In the blackest cell on A block, he hanged himself at dawn with a note stuck to the bunkhead. Don't mess with me, just take me home. Come and lay. Quite alone.
Good evening, this is Ruth Kovach, welcoming you to Prison Pipeline. Thank you all you loyal listeners, and welcome to you to the new listeners. We're a program that tries to do outreach to the friends, family, and loved ones of people who are incarcerated, and especially to those who are in lockdown all over the United States. Some of my favorite facts are that a record number of Americans served time in correction systems across the country in 2007, and according to a report released Monday by the Pew Center on the States, this was back in the first week of March, America's prison population has skyrocketed over the past quarter century. In 1982, one in 77 adults were in the correctional system in one form or another, totaling 2.2 million. However, it now has gone to the U.S. correctional population of those in jail, prison, or probation, or on parole, totaled 7.3 million, or one in every 31 adults. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison inmates are right here. Tonight we're going to use a little bit of Amy Goodman to get us into a conversation about an issue that came to my attention. I guess everyone but me knew more about it, but I think it's something that if I missed it, maybe some of you folks who are listeners missed it. We're going to look at a census-taking device that should concern us all. But first, Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
The other inauguration celebration. For millions of people, both in America and abroad, the inauguration of a black person as President of the United States was a moment of transcendent history, one of meaning and significance that suggests real change in a nation that has long labored under its racist history. This was perhaps best evidenced by the vast number of people who trekked to Washington to be a part of such a day. But for half a dozen men in Pennsylvania's Camp Hill Prison, in its SMU, or Special Management Unit, the day will be remembered quite differently. For that day marked a fit of beatings, electric stun gun shockings, kickings, punchings, and other such treatment, accompanied by a rash of racist slurs by white guards against black prisoners. According to the Pittsburgh-based Human Rights Coalition, guards and staff launched an attack timed to the inauguration to send the message, F an historical day. You're always going to be niggers. In an extensive six-page report sent to members of the press, the coalition's fed-up chapter documents assaults and threats against six men, David Smith, Gary Tucker, DeMont Hagen, Ronald Jackson, Willie Robinson, and Jamar Perry. Some of these men were threatened with death for daring to file suits in court against their treatment in the unit. On the morning of the inauguration, one high-ranking guard reportedly announced over the PA system he, speaking of Obama, may have won. In my eyes, he's still a nigger. He also stated, there will be no showers or yard today. We're going to show you niggers who run this SMU. Men were handcuffed, sprayed with hot pepper mace, blinded, stripped naked, and beaten in retaliation for exercising their alleged constitutional right to file a civil rights suit in an American court. On the same day that Obama was taking the oath of office, telling the nation and the world that we do not torture. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thank you, Mumia.
Are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thank you, Mumia. I don't know why I'm always glad to hear what he has to say, because so much of it is really very tragic. That was certainly a few comments that I wish weren't true, but I know that Mumia does his homework, he does his research, and if he says it happened, I believe it. Tonight, we're going to talk about a situation that I described to you in my introductory remarks as a census-taking device that should concern us all. This came to my attention on a program presented by Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, on March 3rd, 2009. I'm hoping that everyone who listens and is interested in Prison Pipeline also pays attention to Democracy Now! By Amy Goodman. However, I know KBOO presents Amy Goodman at 7 in the morning and at 4 in the afternoon, so a lot of folks who have jobs and are working or folks who are in lockdown don't have access to a radio and perhaps don't listen to it. Based on that belief, I'm going to play a few minutes of her program, and then I'll be summarizing the rest of it, because it's just much too long to play at all. She gives an hour's program, but it gives you a feel for who she was talking to, and when I quote their comments later in the program, you'll be able to identify with that. America's record prison population has a huge budgetary effect, and according to the report that we're going to be hearing, increased corrections spending outstrips everything at the state level except for Medicaid. This is, you know, a fact we have to deal with. The Senate Republicans, who hold 30 of the 62 states in the chamber, could block a bill that is now pending to get rid of some of the laws made by Rockefeller back in 1973. And we're going to see that Amy begins her program by talking about the Rockefeller law and trying to get rid of it. And it's later in the program that she gets to the census part. So hang in there. I think that you're going to benefit from hearing about both of these things. However, the lack of what those involved in criminal justice considered successful treatment programs led Rockefeller to seek life sentences for the most serious drug offenses. And the Rockefeller initially helped build one of the most extensive state treatment programs in the nation. He became exasperated as drug felons slipped through the cracks and New York's drug epidemic only grew worse. By 1973, Rockefeller was disgusted and frustrated, said Pamela Grissett, an associate professor of criminal justice and legal studies at the University of Central Florida. So what he proposed was a 180-degree turnaround from the rehabilitation sentencing structure that he had first favored. So some of you remember your history and some of you remember things you heard. Rockefeller at one time was labeled as a person who was quite a promoter, quite an advocate of rehabilitation programs. And then in 1973, when he did a turnaround and proposed the laws that Amy's going to talk about in her segment, he turned around because he thought he had to play tough guy. The drug problem under his jurisdiction had gotten worse instead of better. And so being the big shot ruling legislator, he had to turn it around by get tough laws. And that's what went on. So now I think we're going to just listen to a bit of Amy, and I'll be back with you in a few minutes.
For more than 35 years, thousands of nonviolent drug offenders have been jailed for lengthy terms under New York's draconian Rockefeller drug laws. The laws impose lengthy minimum sentences on drug offenders, even those with no prior convictions. The laws have disproportionately targeted people of color while giving prosecutors de facto control over how long convicts are jailed. But those laws could be on their way out. The New York State Assembly is set to vote today on legislation that would allow judges to send drug offenders to substance abuse treatment instead of prison. The legislation would also allow thousands of prisoners jailed for nonviolent drug offenses to have their sentences reduced or commuted. New York Governor David Patterson is also preparing a measure that would let judges determine sentences instead of having to follow state-imposed mandatory minimums. It's the latest step in a long campaign to repeal the Rockefeller drug laws. The effort's been propelled by a grassroots campaign involving many ex-prisoners. I'm joined now by two guests. Here in the Firehouse studio, Kirk James was released in 2003 after serving 9 years in jail as a first-time offender. He's now a social justice activist who actively campaigns against the Rockefeller drug laws. Also in the Firehouse studio, Caitlin Dunkley. She's coordinator of the Correctional Association's Drop the Rock campaign, the main grassroots campaign to repeal the Rockefeller drug laws, along with the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial and Social Justice. And on the line with us from state capital of Albany is Assemblymember Jeff Aubrey. He represents New York's 35th Assembly District in Queens. He's led efforts in the New York State Legislature to repeal the Rockefeller drug laws. Well, why don't we begin with Assemblyman Jeff Aubrey. Tell us what the legislation that you've co-sponsored is today. Many have characterized it as repealing the drug laws, but it's not exactly doing that.
It doesn't entirely repeal all that Rockefeller does, but it does restore discretion to judges for offenses from the B level down, so that a judge will no longer have be bound by the mandatory minimum and will be able to use a variety of options regarding sentencing for someone who is convicted or pleads to a drug possession or sale charge.
Explain what a mandatory minimum is.
A mandatory minimum essentially establishes a minimum number that an individual must serve if convicted. There is no discretion associated with that. That would mean that that person must go to prison and must serve that particular period of time. And by removing it, we give, as I say, the option for treatment or split sentences or a variety of options that a judge might fashion once he looks at the full evidence of a case after a trial.
Kirk James, why don't you tell us your story?
Hey, how you doing, Amy? Well, I was incarcerated 18 is the first time as a first-time offender, so to speak. I was a first-year college student who was approached by an undercover informant who actually turned out that he worked for the ATF. And this
Bureau
person,
of Alcohol, Tobacco, Fine.
Yeah, and what this person actually did was, I like to say that I was entrapped. I don't know what better word to say, but I never sold drugs. I never had any involvement with drugs. And this person told me that if I could arrange for his friends who were looking to buy drugs, that they would pay me a substantial amount of money. So this occurred over a few months where I said no. I initially declined the offer, and he was very persistent. He told me that the money would be great and that they'd be willing to pay a lot more than the street value, so to speak. I was eventually able to find someone who would be able to provide the drugs for them. And so I acted as a medium, so to speak. And this went on for a period of 4 months where drugs was exchanged. I had no direct, I wasn't involved directly in the sale, so to speak. I mean, I helped to arrange the sale, to facilitate the sale. And make a long story short, after 4 months, I was incarcerated. And turned out that, you know, everything unfolded that these guys were ATF agents and that, you know, I was facing a substantial amount of time in prison. Actually, my first offer was 40 to life. 40 years to life in prison. And as a first-time offender who had no knowledge of the criminal justice system and didn't, like, I don't want to say I was young and naive. I knew clearly that, you know, I was agreeing to something that
was
wrong.
Were you accused of, did you have weapons? Were you accused of hurting someone?
No. No.
This was a first-time offense.
First-time offense. Like I said, I'd never been in trouble before. I was 18 years old. I was actually a college student. No history whatsoever, and no prior criminal activity. I'll be very clear on that. That this was actually my first time involved in any type of criminal activity. That's why I use the word entrapment, so to speak. So I was in this situation. I mean, as an 18-year-old, you can imagine I was very scared. I was very afraid. And like I said, my first offer was 40 years of life. Eventually, my family was able to afford legal representation, and by then, you know, the entire story came out, and, it, you know, I had numerous charges, even though, like I said, I didn't have any direct involvement in the sales. I was charged acting in concert. So I had numerous charges, and these charges were what's considered A1 felonies, A1 felony being the highest felony you can under Rockefeller drug laws, which each conviction lead into a term of 15 to life minimum. So after about 6 months in the legal process, my lawyer didn't feel that it would be very wise for me to go to trial and actually steered me towards taking a plea of 7 to life with the belief that I'd be out a lot sooner. He told me that I'd be eligible for work release programs, I'd be eligible for different type of
How long
release
did
programs.
You serve?
I ended up serving 9 years in prison.
9 years?
Yeah.
How unusual is this, Caitlin Dunkley?
Not unusual at
How many people are in jail as a result of the Rockefeller drug laws?
Right now, as we're sitting in this room, there's 12,000 people who are serving time under the Rockefeller drug laws in New York. 12,000.
You're with the Correctional Association. Explain what that is.
The Correctional Association is a nonprofit agency that was founded in 1844 and works on a range of incarceration policies and prison policies. And Drop the Rock is the campaign, the statewide grassroots campaign to repeal the Rockefeller drug laws.
What is your assessment of the bill that the New York legislature is going to be voting on today, the assembly?
I think it's a really positive step forward. And I think Jeff Aubrey, Assemblymember Jeff Aubrey, for all of his leadership on this issue for years and years. He introduces a full repeal bill every year, and that's the bill that we support entirely. The reform bill, which is going to be voted on, I believe, tomorrow in the State Assembly, is, like I said, a step forward, but has also some shortcomings to it.
What are your concerns?
My concerns are that it limits judicial discretion in many cases. And so, in particular, if people have any history of a violent felony in their past, in the past 10 years, if anyone, excuse me, is selling drugs to a minor, if anyone is charged with a sex offense, and if anyone has a gun during the commission of the crime, all of those people are going to face mandatory sentences, and the judge's hands are going to be tied in those cases.
Meaning the judge has no discretion.
Well, this is a very good sampling of how Amy interviews people, some of the information she presents. This incident certainly gives you a glimpse of the young folks who are serving long sentences for nonviolent drug offenses. There are statistics out there that this is the only country in the world that gives such long sentences for non-drug, non-violent drugs.
sale, use, or possession. And later in the program, they get talking to Jeff Aubrey about this census-taking issue, which is what I really want to get into for sure tonight. And I found a little thing here that the Census Bureau's counting of prisoners' benefits in some of the rural voting districts. I'd like to tell you about that. Danny R. Young, a 53-year-old backhoe operator for Jones County in eastern Iowa, was elected to the Anamosa City Council with a total of two, count them, one, two, two votes, both write-ins, one from his wife and one from a neighbor. So how does this happen, you ask? Well, Mr. Young's ward has roughly the same population as the city's three other wards, or about 1,400 people. His constituents wield about 25 times as much political clout because his constituents is a very small number. That is because his ward includes 1,300 inmates housed in Iowa's largest penitentiary, none of whom can vote. So only 58 of the people who live in Ward 2 are non-prisoners. That discrepancy has made Anamosa a symbol for a national campaign to change the way the Census Bureau counts prison inmates. Mr. Young was asked, does he consider these voters his constituents? He said they don't vote, so no, I guess I don't really consider the people who are in lockdown as constituents. Therefore, his efforts, his planning, his evaluation of how things should be changed or not changed in his ward have absolutely no concern for 1,300 of the 1,400 people in his district. Critics say the census should count prisoners in the district where they lived before they were incarcerated. Any such changes would probably require congressional approval. It could benefit Democrats since it would add population to the party's urban strongholds and subtract from the Republican-dominated rural areas where most prisons are. Only with one exception nationwide, Mr. Wagner reported, every time a community learns that prison populations are distorting their access to local government, the legislature has reversed course and redrawn districts based on actual populations. The sole exception he cited is St. Lawrence County in upstate New York. Each legislator on the county board represents 7,500 residents, the board's vice chairman reported. But in two districts, over 1,000 of those residents are prison inmates. Mr. Cobb hopes to replace a referendum on the ballot to change the appointment process before the 2010 elections. The Prison Policy Initiative found that 21 counties across the country where at least one in five people, according to the Census Bureau, were actually inmates from another county. In Lake County, Tennessee, 88% of the population in one county commissioner district are prisoners. 88%. Anamosa, population 5,700, is the best known as Iowa's pumpkin capital, the birthplace of the artist Grant Wood and the home of American Motorcycle Museum. It's also the home of the Anamosa State Penitentiary in Ward 2, where more than 95% of the population is in prison, according to the census. I wanted to give you some of this background so that I could move on to other things in Amy Goodman's program, which, because of time, I'll be summarizing. If you really get into this as much as I did, those of you who have access to the web could go to Democracy Now!, could search for the March 3rd program, could search for the segments about penitentiaries and the Rockefeller reforms and so on, and hear every word of things that I'm going to be reading excerpts from. I suggest that you do that. It's very interesting. I'd like to try to get this down in the language that I would explain it to my grandson in, and that's this. Here's a district that you count the population and that decides if you get a representative or not. Now we have five districts, and they all have the same population, and so they each get one representative. However, one of those districts might be 22, 55, 88, 95% incarcerated people who have no vote. So, okay, isn't that a shame that we're getting representatives from certain districts which are really put into position based on a census that includes people who can't vote? Here's the next thing that happens when this census tells us what that district represents. In state budgets, when we get to the distribution of health, welfare, and education funds, those also are based on population or census. So we will find a district that is as much as 88% incarcerated people getting the same distribution of funds for health, welfare, and education as another district that has no prison. Well, I'm sorry, folks. This really outraged me. It just sounds so simple and so clear that this is wrong, 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 that I got myself all excited, and I spend about a week searching the web, and I have a pile of papers in front of me here that if they gave me 3 hours to present this program, I still wouldn't be able to present all the information that I have. So I'm just going to highlight some of the things that Jeff Aubrey, who is definitely an advocate of correcting this problem, some of the things that he said on the Amy Goodman Show. He pointed out that it costs about $40,000 a year for an incarcerated individual's care. And the estimated cost, if these rehabilitation programs and other things that he recommends were implemented, they could reduce that $40,000 cost down to $15,000. So maybe you don't think that everyone who's in prison deserves an even break. Maybe you think anyone who commits a crime, do the time, lock them up, throw away the key. Do you really want to spend $40,000 a year instead of $15,000 a year to take care of these people, not for 1 year, not for 10 years, but in the case we first heard James Kirk, some judge wants to give them 40 years? Well, again, where is your outrage? I don't know. Assembly Jeff Aubrey, in his interview with Amy Goodman, said that in certain areas of our state, in certain senatorial districts particularly, there are numerous numbers of prisons, and so prison population in those districts are clearly political issues. The location of a prison is a political issue. We want to keep building more and more new prisons, and everyone is saying, lock them up, lock more people up, tough on crime, and when you get them locked up, keep them there longer. Oh, now we have a population boom. Instead of a million prisoners, we have 2.7 people incarcerated. And where will we put these prisons? We place them strategically where there is a political advantage to people who advocate tough on crime, keep the population of prisons up. And because those districts are enhanced by this growth in the population of the prisoners, they get even more power and more strength to implement some of the things that they're advocating. We, in fact, engaged in a battle. The governor has proposed, I'm quoting Jeff Aubrey again, the governor has proposed closing some upstate camps because the prison population in the last 10 years has dropped from some 70-plus down to 60,000, and hopefully will go down to 50,000. Now, there's a huge resistance, and there was last year, to closing any of these camps. These are smaller facilities upstate because of the loss of jobs and the potential. You know, he wants to protect the jobs of the guards and the prison personnel and the people, the services who provide towels and food and things to the prison, to the stores and restaurants and hotels that offer accommodations to the visitors to these prisons. And he said these camps would be threatened potentially and go out of business if we reduce the population. And so I don't think that that's exactly a cynical thing to say, that it is not a question of helping protect those jobs. It is a political manipulation. It is a reality that keeping prisons open with as large a population as possible is something that we want to do. Now, also on Amy Goodman's program was Caitlin Dunkley. And among other things, she said, when asked about this particular issue, she said, the people who are incarcerated in upstate communities are actually counted as residents of those districts, not as residents of the districts of New York where they were born and raised, committed their crime, went to trial, were convicted, but they're shipped up to a place that needs a little census building. And those residents allow upstate senators, and particularly Republican senators, to maintain the minimum number of people that they need in their districts in order to have a state Senate district. 90% of the people who are incarcerated are people of color and under Rockefeller, and they're over 60% are people from the five boroughs that are in this upstate prison. Well, I'm watching the clock, and I'm getting the signs, and I guess I get a little excited and carried away, and I don't want to quit because there's lots more to say about this. So what I think you need to do is the same thing I did. Search the web. Start with Amy Goodman's program, then put in keywords like census taking of the prisons, and try to remember we've got a lot of work to do. Prison Pipeline is here to help direct you in the work that needs to be done. And in the meantime, as an individual, you should visit your loved ones, send them a letter, take good care of them. And by the way, my next big announcement in a few weeks is going to be about a new book by Mamia Abu-Jamal called Jailhouse Lawyers. We're going to have a lot of interesting things to say about that. And I guess they're going to give me the hook and pull me right out of the studio if I don't say to everyone, thank you, Kabu. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Emmy Goodman. Thank you, Jeff Aubrey. And thank you, everyone who works for prison reform. Good night.
Well, I'm going in that captain. He's trying to lose my man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven-loving light on me. When he gets up in the morning, when that big bell rings, goes a marching to the table. He meets the same old thing, not talking on the table.